Peter stops with his hand on the door handle, rests his forehead gently against the door, as if he were trying to hear how the house is breathing, if anyone's awake inside. Not long ago, when she thought he was asleep, he heard Kira talking on the phone to someone in the kitchen. For 20 years, he said that next year it will finally be my turn to focus on my career. Next year. Does he really think he's the only person driven to find out how good he can be at something? For 20 years, Peter has told himself that he's doing this not for his own sake, but for other people's. He became a professional hockey player in Canada so he could provide for his family. He took the job as general manager in Beartown because the family needed a safe place after they'd lost Isak. He fought for the club because he was fighting for the town. Because Beartown ice hockey was the pride of the community, the only way for this whole chunk of the country to remind the big cities that there were still people living here, that they could still give them a thrashing. But he isn't sure anymore. Maybe he's just being selfish? He tries to stop thinking about the death notice. He's always been prone to worrying, anxious about everything from bills to whether the coffee machine is switched off. But tonight is something different. Tonight he's scared. He's just put the key in the door when a metallic click makes him start. A car door swings open out in the street. A black-clad man gets out and walks toward him. Two cars are driving through the forest. One of them drives all the way to the kennels, and a man in a black jacket that can't possibly be fastened over his muscular chest gets out. He shakes Audrey's hand. Audrey was in high school with him half a lifetime ago and has nothing against him, except for the fact that he's less sharp than someone suffering from rheumatism handling a disposable camera. Once she had to explain to him that south on the map didn't actually mean a downward slope, and another occasion that islands didn't float on the sea but were actually fixed to the ocean floor. He doesn't have many branches on his family tree. He's got himself a new tattoo on his hand, she notices, a spider web so uneven that it practically forces her to ask, "What the hell, did you lose a bet or something?" "What?" he answers uncomprehendingly, and stares at his hand, clearly not struck by the fact that it looks as though whoever did it was working in the dark. Someone once called him Spider at school because he had long, thin, hairy legs. He was the sort of boy who didn't care what anyone called him, as long as they knew who he was, so he embraced the insult. He's gotten himself at least a dozen spider-themed tattoos since then, all of them apparently done by drunks sitting on top of a tumble dryer. Audrey shakes her head wearily and opens the boot of Spider's car, which is full of boxes of liquor. Audrey notes that the other car is waiting as usual where the road ends, at the edge of the forest. The driver is sitting inside it so he can warn them if any unwelcome visitors are approaching, but the passenger gets out. Audrey has known him for many years, too, and unlike Spider, he definitely isn't an idiot. That's what makes him dangerous. His name is Tima Renus. He's not particularly thick-set, and he's not particularly tall, and his hair is so neat that his best friends call him the accountant. But Audrey has seen him fight and knows that beneath that hair, his head is made of concrete. His kick is so hard that in this town it's the horses that are frightened of standing behind him. When he was younger, he and his little brother were so notorious that the hunters used to joke, "You know why you should never knock the Renus brothers off a bike? Because it's probably your bicycle." Now that he's older, they no longer tell jokes about him. And if anyone from outside comes to the town asking for Tima Renus, even the smallest child has the sense to answer, "Who?" Tima isn't wearing a black jacket. He doesn't need one. He opens the back door of the car and lets out two dogs. He bought them from Audrey as puppies, so if anyone asks what he's doing here this evening, he can say he's thinking of buying another one. He has no delivery schedule, no fixed routine. Audrey gets a phone call a couple of hours in advance, then he shows up once it's dark. She calls him the wholesaler, half affectionately, half mockingly. She herself is the retailer. Two cars can't go from door to door in Beartown dropping off bottles of drink without attracting suspicion, whereas everyone knows that all the hunters in the area usually drop in at the kennels from time to time to check out the puppies and drink coffee. Perhaps they come a little too often, those hunters, especially before major holidays. But if you ask anyone around here about Audrey, they'll all say the same thing. She makes very good coffee. The men in black jackets always have two cars, and Tima never sits in the one containing the drink. There are police investigations that claim that he's the leader of a violent hooligan gang known as the Pack, who support Beartown hockey. There are plenty of stories of their influencing the club's affairs, that highly paid players on the A-team who don't perform well enough have voluntarily torn up their own contracts, but there's never been any proof. And naturally, there's no proof that the Pack is involved in the organized smuggling of alcohol, or trading in stolen cars and snowmobiles, either. There has never been any proof that the Pack has ever threatened anyone, the way criminal networks everywhere usually have to do in order to establish their violent credentials. Police investigations claim that the Pack don't need to do that because they use hockey games to advertise themselves. The theory goes that anyone who has seen the black jackets packed in the standing area of the rink, or who has heard what they've done to fans of other teams that have challenged them, would understand the seriousness of the situation if they appear on the doorstep. But obviously that's all nonsense. Rumor and exaggeration by city types who've seen too many films. If you ask almost anyone who lives in Beartown about the Pack, they'll just reply, "What Pack?" When Audrey lifts the last crate of drink from the back of the car, she notes that there's a large axe under it. She rolls her eyes. "Seriously, Tima, don't you think it looks a bit suspicious, having an axe in the trunk, when every cop in the district has seen pictures of that counselor's car and head?" There aren't many people who dare take that tone with Tima, but he merely looks amused. "Audrey, think about it. After what happened to that poor woman's car and head, wouldn't it look more suspicious if we didn't have axes in our cars?" Audrey bursts out laughing. "You're such an idiot. Except you're not." Tima smiles. "Thank you kindly." When Anna has fallen asleep out on the island, Maya lies awake and writes lyrics about hatred. Sometimes she carries on so long that she ends up writing about love. Not the earth-shattering, falling-in-love kind, but the boring, whole-of-your-life sort. She doesn't know why, but she's thinking a lot about her parents this summer. When you're a teenager, you want them to be sexless. But somewhere along the way, the smallest memories of affection between our parents get imprinted on our DNA. Parents who divorce, like Anna's, can stop a child believing in eternal love. Parents who stick together for a lifetime can make a child take it for granted instead. Maya remembers such insignificant things from her childhood. The way her mom laughs when she describes her dad's style of dress as plain clothes cop at high school disco. Or the way her dad shakes the all but empty milk carton each morning and mutters, "Welcome to today's Guinness World Record attempt, where we will try to make the smallest cup of coffee in the world." The way her mom loses it if there are socks on the floor, and the way her dad would like to take anyone who doesn't wipe the dish rack in front of a war crimes tribunal. The way her mom moved around the world twice for the sake of her dad's hockey, and the way her dad sneaks admiring glances at her mom when she takes business calls in the kitchen. As though she were the smartest, funniest, most stubborn, most argumentative person he's ever met, and that he still can't quite believe she's his. The way Maya and Leo didn't know their parents' real names for years, because they just called each other darling. The way they've never mentioned the word divorce, not even when they're having a row, because they know that's the nuclear option. And if you threaten it once, every argument from then on will end the same way. The way they suddenly seem to have stopped squabbling about little things now. The way the house has gotten quieter. The way they can hardly look each other in the eye anymore after what happened to Maya. The way they can't bring themselves to show each other just how badly they were broken by it. Children notice when their parents lose each other in the very smallest ways, in something as insignificant as a single word, such as "your." Maya texts them each morning now and pretends it's to stop them worrying about her, even though it's actually the reverse. She's used to them calling each other Mom and Dad, as in, Mom didn't really mean you were grounded for 1,000 years, darling, or Dad didn't demolish your snowman on purpose, he just tripped, darling. But suddenly, one day, almost incidentally, one of them writes, Can't you call your mom? She worries so much when you're not home. And the other writes, Remember, your dad and I love you more than anything. 4 letters can reveal the end of a marriage. Your. As if they didn't belong to each other anymore. Maya sits on an island in a lake far out in the forest and writes songs about it because she can't bear to be at home and watch it happen. Minefield. This is a minefield you're walking on. Every word a bomb, but you go on walking. Until there's a quiet click beneath a foot, and then it's too late to go back. The worst thing about being a victim is the victims I turned you into. I can't mend you now, no matter how much I want to. It's like I was the one who died, but you're the ones who were buried. Like I was the one he broke, but you're the ones who snapped. The men in black jackets shake Audrey's hand and walk toward the cars, but Tima stays where he is and lights a cigarette. Audrey tucks a wad of chewing tobacco the size of a baby's fist under her lip. She isn't an idiot either. She knows who the pack are and what they're capable of, but she's a pragmatic person. One summer a few years ago, Beartown suffered a series of break-ins. A gang showed up at night with vans, and on one occasion, an elderly man got beaten up when he tried to stop them. Another time, a neighbor called the police while the burglary was in progress. One solitary police car appeared 3 hours later. Audrey remembers how a few months earlier there had been reports of illegal hunting of wolves in the forest not far from here, and the police had shown up with helicopters, the National Crime Unit, and a SWAT team. Whatever your views on that, when Audrey sees wolves getting better protection than pensioners, she has more faith in the criminals standing beside her than in the criminals in the government and on the council. It has nothing to do with morals. Most people are like her. Pragmatic. When the gang came back, men in black jackets were waiting for them. Everyone else in Beartown closed their doors that night, turned up the volume on their televisions. No one asked any questions afterward. There were no more break-ins. Tima is a lunatic. Audrey won't argue with anyone about that. But he loves this town the same way she does. And he loves hockey. So now he's grinning like a fool. Benji's playing on the A-team this autumn, isn't he? You must be so goddamn proud. Have you seen the list of games? Is he stoked? Audrey nods. She knows that on the ice, Benji is everything Tima wants in a Beartown player. Tough, fearless, mean. And he's from here. A local boy made good, a boy next door. Men like Tima love that. And yes, Audrey's seen the game schedule. It was posted online that morning. Beartown is playing Head Hockey in the first game of the autumn. He'll be playing, if there's a Beartown club for him to play in, she says with a dry laugh. Tima smiles, but the look on his face is increasingly hard to interpret. We're relying on Peter Anderson to solve that. Audrey peers at him. It was the pack who made sure that Peter won the vote of confidence back in the spring and kept his job as general manager. No one can prove it, but everyone knows. Without their votes, Peter would have been out. Now the club has lost almost all its sponsors to Hied, so the pack were taking a big risk. Ramona, owner of the Bearskin Pub, usually says, Tima may not know the difference between right and wrong, but he knows the bloody difference between good and evil. Perhaps she's right. The pack lined up behind a general manager and his daughter against the team's star player, Kevin. But that could be a dangerous burden for the general manager if he steers the PAX club into bankruptcy. Are you really relying on Peter? I saw the announcement of his death in the paper, Audrey points out. Tima raises an eyebrow. Perhaps someone was trying to make a joke. Perhaps someone from your part of the stand was trying to send a message? Tima rubs his head with a fake look of concern. It's a big stand. I can't control everything. If Benji gets caught up in any of this, I'll kill you. Tima suddenly bursts out laughing, and the sound echoes through the trees. There aren't many people who talk to me like that, Audrey. I'm not many people, she replies. Tima lights another cigarette from the butt of the last one. It was you who taught your brother to play hockey, wasn't it? I taught him how to fight. The trees echo to the sound of Tima's laughter again. Who wins if you fight now? Audrey looks down. Her voice becomes thicker. I do, because I have an unfair advantage. Benji can't hurt anyone he loves. Tima nods appreciatively. Then he pats her arm and says, We only ask one thing of Benji out on the ice, the same thing we ask of everyone. That he should do his best and have fun? She suggests tartly. Tima grins. So does she, eventually. Because she knows what he means. Win. That's all anyone ever asks of you around here. Tima hands her an envelope and says, Ramona heard that you and Suna have started a girls' team for 5-year-olds. This is from the kitty. Audrey looks up in surprise. The kitty is a small box of cash Ramona keeps at the Bearskin for the regulars who lose their jobs and can't pay their bills. All the tips end up there, and people leave more tips at the Bearskin than you might think. Tima always pays double for his beer, because once when he was younger and had thrown out another of his mother's more unpleasant boyfriends, someone came around and gave the family an envelope like this one. Tima never let anyone hit his mother again, and when he got old enough to build up the pack, he never forgot the generosity of the Bearskin's regulars. So now, he says, for sticks and skates, or whatever the girls need. Audrey nods gratefully. When Tima turns to walk back to the car, she calls after him, Hey, give Peter Anderson a chance. He might yet find a way to save the club. Tima closes the trunk of the car with the axe still inside. I am giving Peter a chance. If I wasn't, he wouldn't still be in town. Peter stands outside his house but lets go of the door handle, takes the key out of the lock, and turns anxiously toward the street. Richard Teo is walking toward him, dressed in a black suit even though it's the middle of the summer. They've never spoken to each other as far as Peter can remember, but obviously he's well aware of who Richard Teo is. He knows what sort of politics Teo represents, and he doesn't like it. It's aggressive, it sets people against each other, and above all, Richard Teo has given Peter the impression several times that he really hates hockey. Good evening, Peter. I hope I'm not intruding, Teo says. There's something ominous in his friendly manner. Can I help you? Peter asks, rather confused. No, but I can help you, Teo replies. With what? The politician's mouth cracks into a smile. I can save your hockey club, Peter. I can give you one last chance to be a winner. Chapter 12. I am prepared to burn in here. Anyone who devotes his life to being the best at one single thing will be asked, sooner or later, the same question. Why? Because if you want to become the best at something, you have to sacrifice everything else. So the very first time Kira met Peter, that evening in the Capitol when Peter had just lost the biggest hockey game of his life and stumbled dejectedly into Kira's parents' restaurant, that was what she asked him. Why? He could never answer it properly, and that drove her mad. But many years later, when they were married and had kids and a whole life together, she read a 100-year-old quote from a mountaineer. He was asked, Why do you want to climb Mount Everest? The mountaineer replied in bemusement, as if the question was ridiculous and the answer obvious. Because it's there. Kira understood then, because why had she wanted to go to university when no one else in her family had been? Why had she chosen law when everyone had told her it would be too hard? Why? To find out if she could do it. Because she wanted to climb that damn mountain. Because it was there. So she knows what's happening now, possibly before Peter understands it himself. She stands behind the front door and hears enough of his conversation with Richard Tew. Her husband is going to find a way to save his club and make himself indispensable again, the way he always does. Kira sits in the hallway until she hears the Volvo start up and watches through the window as Peter drives off. The bottle of wine remains unopened. She puts the glasses back into the cupboard, and the skin beneath her wedding ring is cold when she goes to bed. A night will pass, and tomorrow she will wake up and try to pretend that everything is fine, even though she knows that each day that passes now means it will be even longer to next year. Peter drives aimlessly for hours, alone, constantly asking himself the same questions. How much is a hockey club worth? Who is it for? How much is it allowed to cost? And somewhere beneath those are other questions. What can I do apart from hockey? What sort of man would I be without it? He's never loved anyone but Kira, and he knows she'd be delighted if he gave up ice hockey. But deep down, would she really? She fell in love with a man with dreams and ambitions, so how will she look at him if the years just keep passing and he never amounts to anything? When dawn breaks, the light pours over Beartown in the way Peter's mother always said about summer, as if the Lord God himself were pouring orange juice over the treetops. Peter is sitting outside the supermarket with his eyes closed, asking himself the same questions over and over and over again. The first thing Richard Tew said to him last night was, "You don't like my politics, do you?" Peter replied thoughtfully, "With all due respect, I don't agree with what you stand for. You're an opportunist." Tew nodded and seemed not to take offense. "You're only an opportunist until you win. Then you're the establishment." When he saw Peter's look of distaste, he added, "With all due respect, Peter, politics is about realizing that the world is complicated, even though people like you would prefer it to be simple." Peter shook his head. "You thrive on discord. Your type of politics creates conflict, exclusion." The politician smiled understandingly. "And hockey? What do you think that does to everyone who isn't on the inside? Do you even remember me from school?" Peter cleared his throat awkwardly and muttered, "You were a few years below me, weren't you?" Tew shook his head, not angrily, not accusingly, but almost sadly. "We were in the same class, Peter." Peter doesn't know if Tew planned that to get him off balance, but it worked. When Peter looked down at the ground, shamefaced, the counselor smiled happily and then explained very plainly why he had come to see Peter. "I have certain contacts in London. I know which company is going to buy the factory in Beartown." "I didn't even know it was being sold," Peter exclaimed. But the politician merely shrugged his shoulders modestly. "It's my job to know things that no one else knows, Peter. I know a lot of things about you, too. That's why I'm here." Leo wakes up in an empty house the next morning. His mom has left a note on the kitchen table. "I'm at work. Your dad's at the rink. Call if you need to. There's some extra money on the counter. We love you, Mom X." Leo isn't a child anymore. He notices the word "your" as well. Your dad, not mom's other half. The boy goes into his big sister's room, closes the door, and curls up on the floor. Maya's notebooks are under the bed, full of poems and song lyrics, and he reads them through different types of tears. Sometimes hers, sometimes his own. Maya was never like other big sisters who yelled and threw their younger siblings out of their rooms. When Leo was younger, he was allowed to come in here. Maya let him sleep in her bed when he was frightened, when they eavesdropped on their parents in the kitchen and heard them fall apart when they talked about Isak. The floor next to Maya's bed was always Leo's safest place. But he's older now, and Maya is spending the whole summer out in the forest with Anna. Leo used to ask Maya's advice about everything, so he doesn't know who to ask now about what a little brother is supposed to do for his big sister when she gets raped, or what he can do for his parents when they let go of each other. or what to do with all the hatred. At the back of a notepad under Maya's bed, he finds a page entitled The Matchstick. He very carefully tears it out and puts it into his pocket. Then he goes down to the beach. He keeps scratching himself the whole time, hard and deep. He tugs his sleeves farther down over his hands. Those rainy days could have been a chance for emotions in Beartown and he had to cool off, but William Leet has sweated his way through them. His coach once said to him that he had never seen anyone play with such an immense need for validation. Maybe he meant it as an attempt to get William to talk about his complexes, but William took it as a compliment. Throughout his childhood, William had fought to become Kevin's best friend again. He used to be, when they were little, driving pedal cars outside Kevin's house and playing hockey indoors in William's basement. Then they started playing hockey, and suddenly Benji appeared. Kevin never stood next to William in team photographs after that. William did what he could to break Benji, teased him about his cheap secondhand clothes and called him Sledge, until Benji whacked him in the face with the sledge, costing William both his front teeth and the respect of the changing room. William's mother demanded that Benji be punished for the assault, but the club did nothing. When they got older, William tried to outshine Benji by boasting about girls he claimed to have slept with, making himself out to be a better friend at parties than that tree-climbing pothead. He was lying, of course. He was a virgin longer than most of the team. But one day, Kevin came into the locker room and shouted, "William, your girlfriends are waiting for you out here." Confused, William got up and went out. The corridor was empty, but there was a pack of 10 thick white socks on the floor. Kevin was roaring with laughter. "That way your mom won't have to do the washing every time you sleep with one of your girlfriends." William never forgot the way the team laughed at him, especially the way Benji did. William has spent years playing with a desperate need for validation, so now what? He had hockey as a fresh start for him, a chance to finally become a leader. He's never going to let himself be the guy with the socks again. While it's been raining this summer, he has been weight training nonstop and watching the video online of his red He Had Hockey flags burning, over and over again. He was hoping to find a tiny clue as to the identity of the cowardly bastard who had posted it, and eventually he thought he had spotted something. The hand holding the lighter in the video was small, a junior school kid's, and when his sleeve slipped back over his wrist, his lower arm looked as though it was covered with scratch marks. William calls the biggest guys in his team. They buy cigarettes and set off for the beach. The Matchstick. If there is a darkened room and you lock up a child who is terrified of the dark, if they are left there with their blackest fears because life is a bastard, if it was you in that room and you found a single matchstick in your pocket, you would light the match, even if the room smelled of gas. Only a few degrees separate rain from snow. All houses are built up but burned down. You have shown me things I fear more than death, so I am prepared to burn in here if I can do it with you. When the sun returns to Beartown, the beach once more fills with teenagers pretending not to stare at each other's bodies. At first, everything is cheerful and noisy, but soon a frightened silence creeps along the shoreline. Two youths climb into a tree and hang up new He Had Hockey flags. William Leet is prowling between the towels, and he stops at every junior school kid and holds out a cigarette. "Have you got a light?" No one looks him in the eye. He grabs hold of each boy's arm and looks for scratch marks. It's possible that Leet himself doesn't really know what he's hoping to find, because who would dare to confess anything to him here? But he wants him to be afraid, if nothing else, so that he doesn't challenge his team again. With each teenager who shakes his head as he stares down at the sand, William's heart feels a bit lighter. He feels a bit bigger. Then he hears a scraping sound. First once, then once again, immediately afterward, and a slight hiss as the flame ignites. A thin voice behind William says,
I've got a lighter.
Leo's fingers aren't trembling. His sleeve slides up. The scars on his arm stand out vividly. What do you mean you know a lot of things about me? Peter managed to say the previous evening. Richard Teal replied in a carefree, almost cheery way. I know that Beartown Ice Hockey is at most just 3 months away from bankruptcy, even if your friend Tail sells another of his supermarkets. And I know that your A-team coach, Suna, is ill. Peter just gawped at him. At the start of the summer, Suna had started to have trouble with his heart. Audrey Ovich had found him on the floor of his row house when he had failed to show up at the newly formed girls' team skating class. Audrey had called Peter from the hospital, but Suna had asked the pair of them not to tell anyone else. It was just a little murmur, and he didn't want to be some damn martyr. Naturally, they kept quiet, but if Peter were honest, that was much for his own selfish reasons as for Suna's sake. He couldn't recruit a new coach without sponsors or money. He couldn't persuade the team's players to sign new contracts without a coach, and without players, there was no way he could attract either sponsors or a new coach. As I said, Richard Teo said quietly, it's my job to know things. I have friends at the hospital. I'd like to be your friend, too. Then, very calmly and methodically, he went through his offer to Peter. The new owners of the factory would require political investment in order to rebuild the factory. Teo could arrange that. But the owners also recognized that they needed to have the support of local residents, so he had persuaded them that the quickest way to these people's hearts is through hockey. Peter squirmed and did his best to hold his voice steady as he replied, From what I've heard, the other parties don't want to work with you. What reason do I have to believe that you can actually achieve all this? Teal replied serenely, Yesterday the ice rink had a large unpaid electricity bill, Peter. If you'd care to phone and check, you'll find that it's been paid. Is that enough proof? Peter felt very uneasy. Why our club? Why not approach Head Hockey instead? The politician smiled again. Beartown is famous for being hard-working. And what you achieved 20 years ago, when the whole town lined up behind the club, there's a lot of symbolic power in that. What was it used to say? Beartown against everyone else? Peter grunted defensively. I don't think you liked hockey. Teo adjusted his cufflinks and replied, My political stance will always be that taxpayers' money should go to healthcare and jobs, Peter, rather than sports. Peter scratched his head and did his best not to look impressed when he said, So you'll let taxpayers' money go to the factory instead, in return for the new owners sponsoring the hockey club? And that way you get to be the politician who saved both jobs and hockey in Beartown, as well as appearing to save taxpayers' money, which can be spent on healthcare services instead. Bloody hell. You'd win the next election on the back of that. Teo put his hands into his pockets, but without radiating any sense of smugness. You know, we have a lot in common, Peter. We just play different games. And in order for me to play mine, I need to win the next election. In order for you to play yours, you need a club. William is 18 years old and probably weighs twice as much as the 12-year-old boy standing in front of him. But Leo isn't backing down. He meets William's gaze with eyes that seem to think they have nothing left to lose. The whole beach is watching, and even if William hadn't wanted to beat up a boy 6 years younger than him, there's no way he can back down now. His hand grabs Leo by the neck to hold the little bastard's head steady, but something happens to the 12-year-old then. The strangulation prompts panic. His mouth opens instinctively as William's fingernails dig into the flesh beneath his chin. Leo starts to retch, and tears spring to his eyes. There are only two natural responses: desperately clutch at his attacker's hands, or hit out furiously as hard as he can, directly upward. Leo's first blow finds nothing but air, but he takes another wild swing and hits William's ear. No one tells you before the first time you get into a fight, but being hit on the ear is bloody painful. William's grip loosens for a fraction of a second, and Leo seizes his chance. He strikes out as hard as he can, hitting William under his chin, and hears the 18-year-old's teeth crunch together hard. William must have bit his tongue, because when he throws himself at Leo, blood is pouring from his mouth, and then it's all over. William is too big for the 12-year-old to stand a chance. Peter shook his head again at Richard Tew, but not as defiantly this time. "You and I have nothing in common. You're only interested in power." The politician laughed at that, for the first time in the conversation. "Do you really think you're any less political than me, Peter? This spring, when your daughter accused Kevin Erdahl of rape and the sponsors tried to get you dismissed as general manager, you won that vote of confidence because this pack took your side. That's right, isn't it?" Tiny, cold drops of sweat let go of the hairs on the back of Peter's head and made their way down his spine. I had no influence. I never asked," he stammered, but Tiu dismissed his objections. "Everything is political. Everyone needs allies." Peter's pulse was ringing in his ears when he asked, "What do you want from me?" The politician replied frankly, "When everything becomes official, you take part in a press conference. Just smile for the cameras and shake hands with the new owners. In return, you'll get an injection of capital and complete control over the club. No one will interfere with your job. You'll get the chance to build a winning team. All I want is your friendship. That's not too much to ask, is it?" He smiled again, and before Peter could answer, the politician moved on to his most important point. "And one last thing. The new owners obviously don't want to be associated with any form of violence. So when you stand at that press conference, you have to distance yourself from the pack and say that you're going to get rid of the standing areas in the rink." Peter couldn't bring himself to say anything. Tiu seemed to have expected that. He helpfully clarified a few more things, and after he left, Peter just stood there. He didn't know for how long. When Peter eventually got back into his car and drove off into the night, one thought kept drumming through his head. Control of the club? With a decent budget? He had often been accused of seeing himself as slightly morally superior, and perhaps there's been some justification for that. He considers a hockey club to be more than just sports. It should be an incorruptible force that is never governed by money or politics. But how many of his ideals is he prepared to sacrifice? What enemies is he prepared to leave himself with? If he gets the power. If he gets to win. He's on his way to finding out the answers. Richard Tiu got into his car and drove all night, all the way to a small airport where a friend had just landed. Tiu shook hands with his friend, who said irritably, "This better be worth my time." Tiu offered his apologies. "Some things are best not discussed over the phone." "Well then," his friend nodded. Tiu went on. "I can guarantee our friends in London all the political investment in the land and factory that they require, but I need a number of things in return. There's a violent gang of hooligans that's spoiling the club. One counselor can't do much to stop them, but a big new sponsor could, well, you understand, exert a degree of influence." His friend nodded. "The hockey club again. Why is that so important to you?" Tiu smiled. "It's symbolic." "So what do you want?" his friend asked. "The new owners need to set a precondition for their sponsorship agreement, that the general manager of Beartown Ice Hockey speaks out publicly and distances himself from violent fans, and that he gets rid of the standing areas in the rink." "That doesn't sound like a big deal." "It isn't, but it's important that it comes directly from the owners, not from me." His friend gave him his word. They shook hands. The friend got on board a plane. Richard Tew got into his car and all the way back thought that only someone who had never set foot in Beartown could say that what they had just discussed wasn't a big deal. That's why Tew was always one step ahead of everyone else. Nobody bothered to do any research anymore. "William! William!" one of the guys on the team hisses somewhere. Leo is too dizzy to hear where the voice is coming from. He's lying on his back and can't see anything through the punches raining down on him. William raises his arm one last time, but another teammate grabs hold of him and repeats, "William!" From the corner of his eye, William sees his friend nod toward the road behind the beach. A car has stopped there. Two men in black jackets have gotten out. They're not walking toward the beach. They don't have to. The pack has never gotten involved in the activities of the town's teenagers. There's always been a dividing line between the seriousness of A-team hockey and the games of the junior team. But William is no longer a junior, and this is no longer just hockey. William lets go of Leo, gets up hesitantly. The men in black jackets don't move. William spits blood, and red saliva dribbles onto his t-shirt. "That's enough," he mutters quietly, so that no one will hear his voice shaking. He turns and walks away. His teammates follow him. The men in black jackets stand on the road until one of William's friends gets the hint, climbs up into the tree, and takes down the Hied hockey flags. The men in black jackets disappear without a word, but the point has been made. No more Hied hockey on Beartown territory. Leo sits down on his blanket, without bothering to wipe William's blood from his face. His throat is so sore that he's sure something is broken. One of his friends pats him on the shoulder, another one gives him a cigarette. Leo has never smoked in his life, but he can't not start now. It hurts horribly and is incredibly good. He didn't back down in the face of William Leet, and no more red flags are hung from the trees this summer. Perhaps Leo could have made do with that, but his 12-year-old heart is beating to a different frequency now because he's discovered something. Adrenaline. Violence. It's like an infatuation. So tomorrow morning, William Leet's mother will open the mailbox outside their house and discover that it is full to the brim with cigarette lighters. People like William Leet can't ignore that sort of provocation. And people like Leo Anderson count on that. Chapter 13. So they gave him an army. "Everything has its price. Everyone will pay something." Those were the most frequent words from Ramona's husband's mouth when he was alive. The first thing he asked anyone who had bought anything, regardless of whether it was a new car or a second-hand toaster, was, "What did you pay?" And whatever they replied, he would grunt, "They saw you coming. I'd have gotten it for half that." Ramona had been so sick of hearing it, but what she would have given to hear it one more time. He loved her, and he loved hockey, and used to say that the center circle of Beartown's rink was their wedding ring, so he didn't need one on his finger. When life was tough, he never said, "It'll be okay." He just said, "Soon time for hockey." If anyone said, "It's summer," he would correct them and say, "This is preseason." He rearranged the pages of every calendar so that the year started in September, because that's when his year started, when Beartown played its first game. 11 seasons have passed since he left Ramona. Today, a telemarketer is sitting somewhere and dialing a number without really caring whose number it is. "Is that Holger? How are you doing today, Holger?" he says loudly when the call is answered. Holger's been dead 11 years, and he wasn't feeling particularly brilliant before that either. "What do you want, boy?" Ramona replies, standing at the bar with her second breakfast in her hand. The caller taps anxiously at his keyboard. "Is that the Bearskin pub?" "Yes," Ramona says. "I see. Sorry, but Holger is still listed as one of the owners on our files." It's still our pub. It's just that I'm the one doing all the work these days. Ah, what does it say here? Is that Ramona? It is. The salesman takes a deep breath and starts again. Great! How are you doing today, Ramona? Boy, these days there's technology that can help people like me find out where people like you live. I'm sorry? You heard me. A short silence follows. Then eventually the salesman clears his throat and, for slightly unclear reasons, summons up the courage to recite, a little too quickly, I'm selling subscriptions to our skincare products. Every month you receive 8 different products through the post, but you only keep the ones you want and send the others back free of charge. 8? Ramona wonders after 2 large gulps of breakfast. Yes. And I'm supposed to have an opinion about that? Tell me, boy, do you honestly think a person has that much skin? The salesman doesn't have a scripted reply to that, so instead he tries, Right now, we have a very attractive off- Ramona's voice is simultaneously apologetic and irritated, as if she's about to tell him that his cat has been run over, but that it was actually something of a nuisance for her, because the little bugger jumped out of the way the first 2 times she tried. Boy, the people you call probably have their hands full trying to hold their lives together. 8 different skincare products? People just want to make it through the day. The salesman replies in a voice scratchy with cough drops and despair. Me too. Have you had breakfast, boy? That's the most important beer of the day. Probably good for the skin, too, full of vitamins. I'll give it a try, the salesman promises. You know what, boy? If you're ever passing Beartown, you can have one on the house. Beartown? I didn't even know there was a place called that. Ramona hangs up. Everything has its price, Holger said before he left her. And when he was buried, the priest said the same thing. Grief is the price we pay for love, Ramona. A broken heart in exchange for a whole one. He was a bit drunk at the time, of course, that damn priest, but that didn't stop him being right. Everyone pays something, people and communities alike. There was once a time when every telemarketer had heard of Beartown. Beartown? You're the ones with the hockey team, right? In the yard below the apartment blocks in the hollow, some children are playing hockey, using a wall as the goal and soda bottles as posts. Amit is standing at the window of his room watching them. He used to play with his best friends, Zacharias and Lifa. It was an easy game back then, a stick each, a tennis ball, 2 teams. But they're 16 now, almost men. The hollow has gotten worse, unless they've just gotten big enough to see the truth about their surroundings. If you want to understand the hollow, you need to know that everyone who lives here regards the rest of Beartown the way the rest of Beartown regards the big cities. We only exist for them in the form of negative newspaper headlines. Lifa once said to Amit, They love you if you're good at hockey, but they'll only say you're from Beartown when you win. When you lose, they'll say you come from the hollow. Lifa hasn't played hockey for years now. He's changed, become harder. He hangs out with his brother's gang now, does deliveries on his moped carrying a backpack whose contents Amit doesn't know anything about. They see even less of each other now. Zacharias spends his nights at home playing computer games and sleeps all day. His parents are spending the summer with relatives, and Zacharias might as well be living in a different country because he lives his whole life online now. At the start of the summer, Amit would stop at his apartment each day and asked if he wanted to join him for a run, but Zacharias just tried to lure him in to play games and eat toasted sandwiches, so Amit stopped going over to avoid the temptation of spending the summer doing nothing. Nothing leads to nothing. He knows that much. So Amit has been training alone, putting weights on his bed and lifting it like a primitive bench press, doing push-ups until he cries, and running along the roads until he throws up. He goes down to the communal laundry room at night and practices stick-handling pucks and balls between glass bottles, faster and faster. Every other evening, his mom, Fatima, comes home late because she's helping a friend who's ill. Ahmet doesn't know who. He doesn't tell her he misses her because he doesn't want to make her feel guilty. Fatima is the sort of person who looks after everyone who needs her, and her son is big enough to take his place in line. But this evening he isn't training. Or sleeping. The other kids of his age from the Hollow hang out on the hill at night, on the edge of the forest looking out over the old gravel pit. Ahmet can see them from the balcony, cooking hot dogs on barbecues and smoking weed, talking about nothing and laughing. Just being teenagers. Everything has its price. They say you have to spend 10,000 hours practicing to get really good at something. So how many more is it going to cost Ahmet to get away from here? He hasn't even got a team now. After everything he gave up in the spring to stand up and tell the truth about what Kevin did to Maya, he hasn't got anything left. Even Maya's father doesn't give a damn. Ahmet pulls on a jersey, leaves the apartment, and heads up toward the hill. Most of the teenagers around the fires have known him since he was little, but they still look at him like some captive animal that has just jumped out of its cage. He stops, embarrassed, and looks down at the ground until someone suddenly laughs and passes him a cigarette whose contents he doesn't bother to ask about.
"Here, superstar, party time,"
the girl who hands it to him says with a grin. She's sweet. So is the smoke. Ahmet closes his eyes and drifts away. And when she takes hold of his hand, he thinks that maybe he could stay here after all. Everything else can go to hell. Hockey, the club, the demands, the pressure. He's going to let himself be normal, just for one night. Smoke until he sabotages himself and fades away into the night air. He finds himself holding a beer, doesn't know where it came from. Then when another hand comes out of nowhere and knocks his arm so hard that he drops both the beer and the joint, Ahmet yells, "What the hell?" and turns instinctively to shove the idiot in the chest. Lifa, his childhood friend, is big now. His chest doesn't budge an inch. Instead, he grabs hold of Ahmet's jersey and throws him roughly down the slope. Tails, the tall, thick-set supermarket owner who's almost always in a better mood than a Labrador under a water sprinkler, just sits there in shock as Peter tells him the whole story. They're sitting in Tails' office at the back of the shop, full of files containing Beartown Ice Hockey Club's accounts. Tails is the club's last big sponsor and is spending all his time trying to figure out how long he can keep the club alive without the help of the council.
"I don't get it. Why would Richard Tew want you to take a stand against..."
He stands up and closes the door before he finishes his sentence in a whisper.
"The pack."
Peter rubs the dark rings under his eyes. The factory's new owners want to sponsor a family sport. That looks better in the media. They've told Tew that they want to get rid of hooliganism. And after that business with the axe and the counselor's car, well...
"But how's that going to work?"
Tails asks. Peter closes his eyes in exhaustion. "I have to say in a press conference that the club is getting rid of the standing area."
"The pack aren't the only people who use that."
"I know, but everyone in the pack uses it. Richard Tew doesn't care what happens. He's just bothered about how it looks." Tails' eyes open wide.
"He's a smart bastard, that Tew. Everyone knows the pack voted to let you stay on at the meeting in the spring. So if you distance yourself from them in the paper, it will be more effective."
"And Richard Tew gets everything he wants. The factory, jobs, the hockey club. He can take the credit for everything and won't be blamed for anything. Not even the pack will hate him. They'll just hate me. And we'll be giving him everything he needs to win the next council elections."
"You can't do it, Peter. The pack will... You know what they're like. There are some crazy bastards in that gang, and hockey's the only thing some of them have got,"
Tails says. He knows because a few members of the pack work in his warehouse. They work hard, and they make sure everyone else on their shift does too. And if there's ever a break-in at the store,
Tails never has to call a security firm because it gets taken care of. In return, Tails arranges their shifts so they never have to take holiday in order to go to Beartown Ice Hockey's away games. But if the police show up a week later, their names still appear on the rota, at precisely the time when the police are trying to prove that they were involved in hooligan-related violence. "Hooligans? There are no hooligans working here," their employer exclaims uncomprehendingly. "Pack? What pack?" Peter wrings his hands. "What's the alternative?" Tails. "Richard Tew only cares about power, so putting the fate of the club in his hands and those of a bunch of utterly unknown investors is madness. But being realistic, if we don't, the club will be dead anyway in 3 months. I can sell another store or take out a loan on this one," Tails suggests. Peter puts a heavy hand on his friend's shoulder. "I can't ask you to do that, Tails. You've already done more than enough for the club." Tails looks insulted. "The club? The club's you and me." Peter's stern face cracks into a gentle smile. "You sound like Suna, the way he used to go on when we were little. We are the club," he says, imitating the old coach. Tails and Peter used to hate summer when they were children because the hockey rink was closed. They became best friends in an empty parking lot, along with Hog and a few others. Children who didn't care about swimming in the lake or playing war games in the forest. They used to play hockey on the tarmac with battered old sticks and a tennis ball until it got dark, then drag themselves home with scraped knees and 10 world championship wins in their hearts. They're sitting in that very same parking lot now, because that's where Tails built his first supermarket. He puts his hand on an old team photograph on the wall and says to Peter, "I wouldn't be doing it for the club, you idiot. I'd be doing it for you. When we won silver 20 years ago, and you got the puck at the end of the game to take the last shot, do you remember who made that pass?" Does he remember? Everyone remembers. Tails made the pass. Peter missed the net. Tails may feel that they won silver, but Peter just thinks they lost gold. It was his fault. But Tails wipes his eyes with the back of his hand and says quietly, "If I had 100 chances to do it again, I'd pass the puck to you every time, Peter. I'd sell all my stores for you. That's what you do when you have a star in the team. You trust him. You give him the puck." Peter stares at the floor. "Where can a man find friends as loyal as you, Tails?" Tails flushes with pride. "On the ice. Only on the ice." An ancient man shuffles into the bearskin alone. Ramona has never seen him without the other four of the five uncles. He looks as though he's aged half a lifetime, as if the years have hit him all at once. "Have they been here?" he wonders, meaning the friends he's spent every day with for as long as anyone can remember. Ramona shakes her head and asks, "Have you tried phoning them?" The old man looks miserable. "I haven't got their numbers." Year after year, day after day, the five uncles have either been in the stands to watch hockey or here in the Bearskin pub to talk about hockey. They've all used the same calendar, where each year starts in September. Why would they need one another's phone numbers? The old man stands for a while at the bar, lost. Then he goes home. He and his friends, five men who sat in a bar every day to talk about sports. They're not about to become five men who sit in a bar every day and just drink. The youngsters around the fires have fallen silent. In a very short space of time, Leifa has grown from a nobody to the sort of person nobody here messes with. He doesn't even have to raise his voice. "Anyone who gives Amit another beer or cigarette will never enjoy another barbecue here. Understood?" Farther down the slope, Amit coughs as he gets to his knees. Zacharias is standing a short way behind him with melted cheese on his shirt. When Leifa came around to his apartment a short while ago, saying he'd heard that Amit was up on the hill,
Zacharias tried to persuade Leifa to come inside and have a toasted sandwich instead, but Leifa just stared at him until Zacharias grabbed a pair of pants and decided to keep his mouth shut. "I'm partying, Leifa. Mind your own business," Ahmet manages to say. Leifa